This is News and Notes. I'm Ed Gordon. On today's roundtable, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice is dispatched to the Middle East, and schools try to service worship. Joining us from our New York bureau, Robert George. He's an editorial writer for the New York Post. From member station WLIU in Southampton, New York, Marcelo Suarez Orozco. He's a professor of globalization and education and co-director of the Immigration Studies Department at New York University. And also with us, Callie Crossley, social and cultural commentator for the Boston area television show Beat the Press. She joins us from the studios on the campus of Harvard University in Cambridge, Mass. And I thank you all. Greatly appreciate it. Robert George saw a surprise visit by Condoleezza Rice, the Secretary of State, on this morning, landing in Beirut, talking about what we have all been following over the course of the last week, and that is the growing tension and killing in the Middle East, Hezbollah being smack dab in the middle of this. And now we're starting to see from other areas of the Middle East calls for the United States to be, if you will, more even-handed in their direction to calm this problem.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it seems this administration has made a strategic as well as a tactical decision to be even more solidly on the side of Israel in this current conflict. In the past, while it's been very clear ever since at least 1967 that Israel is a clear ally of the United States, other presidents have tried to use the United States as sort of, you know, neutral territory to try and work out some of these issues. This time, this is really an outgrowth of the administration's view on the war on terror. They're figuring Hezbollah is a significant terrorist organization within the Middle East. Israel has a right to defend itself, and given that, I think they want to create a situation not where it's just going to be in their words, a pseudo peace. They want to allow Israel the power to, as they put it, degrade Hezbollah's ability to continue attacks and create a peace with more of stable boundaries.
Yet, Marcelo, what we're hearing from, again, many regions in the Middle East is that if you're looking for peace that is sustainable, it's hard to hold in some people's minds a government totally accountable for what many consider a terrorist organization, and therein lies the problem.
Therein lies the problem, indeed. And in terms of the broader picture here, we have a context in which the situation today is more dangerous in Iraq, in Iran, certainly in Lebanon, and certainly in Syria. So we have a broader context in which the asymmetry of this new kind of conflict, where a pseudo or a phantom state, let's call it, operates within the boundaries of national states, in this case, Lebanon, that are increasingly unable to manage their presence, their activities, damage they can produce. So we are really looking at a context today that is much, much more dangerous. And the question that we really need to ask ourselves is, literally, who is calling the shots here? Will Secretary Rice, will the administration really be able to broker a longer-term contextual solution to a dynamic that is rapidly getting out of control? And that remains to be seen.
Callie, it's hard to answer that question when one now believes that this administration, as Robert pointed out, is perhaps more solidly behind the Israeli government than ever before, and you forget about perhaps the voice of Colin Powell, who, when part of this administration, suggested that there was going to be a need, if ever we were going to see a long-term sustainable peace, a need to be more, again, even-handed with talks and efforts.
And that's the problem. I mean, here we are, and the in the face of the world, the way that we look to the rest of the world is just one-sided. And that is not to say that we are not strong allies of Israel, and we should be, that we as a country should not stand up and say any country that is attacked certainly has the right to defend itself, particularly from an organization, as Marcelo has described, as, you know, some kind of pseudo-state. But having said that, with the eyes of the world looking at us and trying to figure out how we're going to move, it's going to be increasingly difficult to hear us if they're looking at the numbers of civilian deaths pile up in Lebanon. These are innocent people caught in the middle of this. Yes, Hezbollah is operating within the boundaries of that country. Yes, they're backed by Syria and Iran, but these are innocent people. And the stories that have been reported most recently of people trying to leave the country to flee from the violence and getting caught in the middle, that's an image that lingers there. I heard somebody say, is it possible for you to say something critical of Israel without being anti-Israel? And I think that's the crux of the matter right now. How does the United States then put itself in a position to be heard by the rest of the world and certainly to still maintain support of Israel by saying, okay, maybe it's really time to talk about ceasefire. Maybe we have to look about what's going on globally.
And one of the real problems that the administration has right now is that it has had basically two goals, if you will, in the context of the Middle East. On one hand, obviously, is security in terms of getting Al-Qaeda destroyed eventually. But the other goal is this democratization project. And one of the best examples of that until about 2 weeks ago was Lebanon and the Cedar Revolution. And the problem is that even though we solidly put ourselves behind Israel in going back on the attack against Hezbollah has like seriously destroyed large amounts of Lebanon's infrastructure, and that democracy now, I mean, ironically enough, they may now be more willing to listen to the extremist elements that are sympathetic to Hezbollah than to the democratic elements. So I mean, it's a real big obstacle in the broader goal that the administration is trying to create.
And the irony here is, if I may, that it is really by engaging as interlocutors the government of Syria and really the government of Iran that in the long term we will approach a solution to the current context. So, in other words, we're going to need to establish some kind of a communication channel with these regimes that are very unsavory in many ways. That also is another casualty of the, or let's call it the last nail in the coffin of reinventing or introducing democracy in the Middle East. We're going to need to turn to these unsavory regimes to broker some kind of a long-term solution.
And what they're going to do is they're going to try and get Jordan, Egypt, Saudi Arabia to act as a countervailing Arab presence, trying to also bring in Syria on their side as a block against Iran. And it's a very problematic.
Yeah, but, and that's,
so, Callie,
before
we move on, let me ask you this. And that's the idea that in my lifetime, certainly my adult lifetime, we've not seen any sustainable peace for any long term in this area. And you mentioned the idea of being able to speak ill of Israel without being denounced as anti-Israeli. The question becomes, when you're starting to hear others in that area suggest that we are seeing from the Israeli side terrorist acts, in a real sense in their minds, how do you bring the two together and broker the kind of sustainable peace that Condoleezza Rice says we have to see first before the United States steps in?
Well, I think part of that has to do with what Marcelo just said about interacting with what he calls some unsavory folks in the region. And I was struck by the fact that it was announced this morning that the Speaker of the Parliament, you know, some members of Hezbollah are in the Lebanon cabinet. They were elected democratically following our guidance. The Speaker of the Parliament will be in the meeting with Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice. Now, there was a time then, you know, we would say we as a country, we're not sitting down with, quote, terrorists or militants. Mm-hmm. And I think that the fact that he's in the government allows the cover for the United States to say, well, look, the guy's elected. We can sit down and have a conversation. But the bottom line is that she's in the meeting is somebody with a direct link to Hezbollah that can go back and have conversation with some of them. So we are, in fact, trying to figure out ways strategically and in a way that we have never in the past, we as a country, to sit down and have conversations with folks that we wouldn't have talked to before.
Well, and historically, if we think back to Andy Young's intervention during the Carter administration with the PLO, that really is what brokered some of the peace that we saw in that region when we talk about the idea of the PLO not being recognized for years and years and years. And one cannot broker peace if both sides are not at the table. All right, let's turn our attention to what Congress is doing, and that's spending over $750 million to promote marriage, better marriage, and better parenting, particularly from fathers. We're seeing grants being allowed. This is part of what they're calling the shift in welfare reform, Marcelo, up to $100 million a year available to promote better marriage and $50 million a year to produce, as they call it, committed fathers.
This sounds to me like a big broader here, the government should be in the business of providing better schools, better health care, better jobs, and a lot of good will follow. I don't see the government investing millions and millions of dollars in the context of our current predicaments in promoting marriage, promoting better engagement from fathers. That's not the business of the government.
All right, Callie, certainly we're going to hear from people who will suggest that with absentee fathers, particularly in the African-American community, growing and growing by leaps and bounds every year and the divorce rate at over 50%, there will be a need for organizations who work toward eradicating this to receive more money from the government.
Listen, you know, if I thought this would work, I'd be the first person in the front lines. There are so many other elements having to do with it, an intimate relationship that, you know, that no amount of money or programs is going to be able to solve. Now, can you solve some of the situational scenarios around it that might support it? Perhaps, and maybe that's what these folks are thinking about. But here's the irony as I see it. We have Republicans mostly backing this and really feeling very firmly about it. And these are the folks that say government should stay out of people's business. And the second part of that is we have mostly Republicans backing this. And those are the folks who are saying the same-sex marriage, it's undermining marriage. Well, if you really believe that two parents mean something, then quit fighting folks who are trying to have two parents. This is just, I just think it's crazy across the board. I mean, I know that this is going to happen, and I know that lots and millions of dollars are going to be funneled into this. But as one of the experts said, it's quite one thing to get people married. It's another to keep them married.
Yeah, well, I mean, as a Republican who's usually kind of skeptical about sort of what we often refer to as social engineering, this is one of those where my sense is that in the context of the federal budget, we're talking pennies on the dollar. So, I mean, in that sense, it's not a huge amount. And the real tragedy, Ed, is, you know, we talked about absentee fatherhood, you know, growing by leaps and bounds in the black community. The real tragedy is it's not really growing by leaps and bounds because it can't go much further. I mean, we're talking about, children born out of wedlock in the black community about, 65 or 70%.
But how does this help, Robert? How it helps.
My sense is, it's a crisis situation, and if we can devote some monies to, and basically the money goes to local organizations, faith-based organizations, and so forth, if we can try and concentrate some monies there to encourage greater contact, committed relationships, actual marriages, and healthy marriages that stay together. It's better for the child, obviously, in the short term and in the long term, because, you know, we were talking about the schools. Yes, you need to put money into the schools as well, but the fact is that children that are raised in two-parent homes are going to be able to compete better in the schools from day one.
But, Marcella, you mentioned the idea that this may be starting in the wrong place or perhaps down the road a little more than it should. With the instance, let's talk about fathers who aren't around. Many of them aren't around, and I'm not trying to give them a pass here, a hall pass, but the idea that many of them aren't around because they don't feel they feel emasculated, if you will, because many of them do not have jobs, can't support the traditional family role of the father, etc.
Exactly. So the question becomes really, how do we best think about engaging families in the work of nurturing the next generation? And the preponderance of evidence suggests that it is through the engagement in meaningful work, in meaningful community roles and relations. It is in the context of healthy schools that engage children, that engage families. It's a much more of a systemic, complex set of issues than would be resolved by this kind of symbolic politics that, in a way, minimizes the nature of this very serious issue that we're facing with a banal political posturing that is very unlikely to generate the kinds of outcomes that I and I think all of us would tend to favor. Of course, two-parent families tend to have much better long-term outcomes with children.
But I do think it is important to point out that there are actually a number of grassroots organizations coming out of the Black community, Black fatherhood organizations that actually are asking for some of these things. So this is not just completely a white Republican stunt. I mean, there is actually, I think, some grassroots support for it.
And we certainly saw this weekend the importance of having both parents in your life, and particularly for young men, with Tiger Woods winning yet another British Open.
Absolutely.
And the poignant scene of him missing his dad speaks to the importance of parents in one's life. So, Callie, greatly appreciate you being with us today, as well as Marcello and Robert. Thank you so much. Greatly appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.